My mirrors is a sentiment. Come on. Welcome to Fox Hours of Podcast. I'm a Deuce. Seth, you here?
Yep.
It's Timak here. And the best guest is co-host of California. It's Tim Stafford.
Ooh, co-host from California, Tim Stafford.
Yes.
Nice.
Co-host from the best coast.
Whoa. How? Oh, look. Did Tim, did you get your beard trimmed?
No, I don't think so.
You're looking very Folgers coffee-ish today. I like it. Seth Theory, tell us about spring break so far. Where are we going tomorrow?
First of all, I just say Nate.
Yeah, we're going to go see Nate.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Segui, my dad's birthday.
That's right. Daddy Mike's birthday is coming up, huh?
Yes.
That's right. That's going to be awesome. And Seth always picks out the restaurant that we choose to celebrate each of our individual birthdays. And it happens to be his favorite restaurant.
Which so, is?
Red Robin.
Yeah, nothing like quality food for the Erie household.
There you go.
It's just, it's like, yep. I mean, it's funny how that works. The restaurants we all want to go to on our birthday happen to be Seth's favorite restaurant. I don't know.
How does that happen?
Just crazy, huh?
Yeah.
Just crazy. Yes. All right. Do you want to say anything else to everybody before we get started?
And peace out, guys.
Peace out. Nice.
Subscribe or die.
Subscribe or die?
Oh, yes. I like that.
Well.
Voxology is getting dangerous.
Yeah, YouTubers. Subscribe or die. Oh. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. I like that. That was a good cold
open. I like the, is Tim safe? No, he's not. Nope. Absolutely not. And I've learned that DS kids have an unerring radar when it comes to that. Yeah,
so watch out.
Great job. Yeah, great job, Tim. Anything big happening in your world before we dive in? We've got a question, and then we've got some Genesis.
No,
nothing?
I don't think so.
Yes?
No.
How's your old new car?
It's running currently, yeah.
All right, I love one?
That. I have a whole like street the newest, of old used cars.
The newest, oldest.
Yeah, it's running. That's all I can ask for.
And what's your weather? Just brief weather update for Northern.
It's still cold, but it's sunny today, and everything's blooming. And you can see.
So is your face.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, beard, eyes, freckles. We're blooming here in sweet Nashville. It is 75 degrees right now. So it's pretty freaking awesome.
Spring has sprung.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, I just want to say we are so excited about being participants in this sweet little community here that we have together. And one of the things that excites us to no end are the email questions that we get. And if they're broad enough, and if we see them, those are two very big disclaimers, then they're often great fodder for conversation. And so I thought before we dive into more Genesis, and the response to Genesis was completely underwhelming, by the way. Compared to parenting, it was like, nope, don't care at all. So... And then our buddy Phil Vischer released a Genesis 1 video on the Holy Post. I'm like, come on.
They had something else. Come on, guys.
Yeah. John Walton was doing something. I mean, come on, guys. Why they got to stomp on us, Tim?
I don't know.
Why they got to? I know. I was like,
David and Goliath over here. Need I remind you who wins that fight? Hey-o.
I mean, hello. All right. So, hi, Seth. Seth's dad and Seth's dad's friend.
There it is.
That's the way you do it. I'm writing because a friend of mine who grew up Catholic and since starting college, we are both sophomores, has begun to attend a more evangelical Protestant church. He didn't have a close relationship with God growing up, but has grown in his faith since arriving at college. I grew up in a small Protestant denomination. I learned a lot of early theology through Christian school and books. And because of our different experiences, sometimes it's hard for me to communicate the ideas I want to communicate to him effectively when we talk about matters of faith. He recently received some guidance from a leader of a campus ministry that we both attend that he had some questions about, and rightfully so. My friend had asked some questions about partying, sex, and drinking. Now, shocking that college students would be asking about these things. First of all, shocking.
Shocking.
Shock and all. He asked some questions about partying, sex, drinking, and that were answered in what was, in my opinion, a very simplistic and bounded way. He was told, among other things, that he should not do anything with a girl that gave him a boner.
I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. That's in Song of Solomon. You got to look very carefully for that. And yeah, you got to read it closely.
That was a surprise. Yep.
And that he shouldn't go to the college bar at our school because he would be misrepresenting the gospel, even if he didn't abuse alcohol, hook up with a girl, or do anything else that would be sinful, and that drinking underage was a sin. He said that a smaller party, like an apartment party, should not be attended by a Christian if there was alcohol there. The justification for the underage drinking thing was Romans 13, which was obey the governing authorities. Apart from that, my friend didn't mention any scriptural backing for any of these assertions, which doesn't mean the leader didn't give any, but that was surprising. To be clear, I have no ill will towards this person and believes that he's well-meaning and genuinely loves college kids and Jesus. I want to do justice to his opinions as well as I can, but I'm going off of the summary I got from my friend on the phone. The leader did mention that a sinful relationship with alcohol is really about the heart, not the act itself, which I believe is a step in the right direction. However, my friend was rightly frustrated with the conclusions the leader drew and said, these are the kind of things that turn me away from Christianity as a whole. Like, I can't do anything. I also found the statements borderline offensive, as I'm someone who does party and who seeks to follow Jesus in all my life, including those settings. I also have some lingering shame from a previous romantic relationship with regards to physical intimacy. That comment was disappointing as well. I was wondering how you would respond to the assertions made by the leader. That is understandable for someone like my friend who hasn't had the evangelical upbringing we or most of the Voxology community has had. So there you go. And seeing as I have two kids in college, and you will have at some point, Lord willing, two kids in college, these are not far off conversations, and oddly enough, kind of fit into the parenting vibe a little bit, right? So, so our listener distinguished already between a bounded answer and a centered answer in the way he even framed this. And if you remember, we did a centered set, bounded set thing that, you know, you can't ever summarize. Are you picking up something? Hey, Jay. What is that? Oh, it was a faucet. Okay. All right. It was a faucet that was super loud. Sorry about that. Timothy. I'm so sorry. It was so loud. I was like, what is that noise? We're a highly professional podcast. Dude. And I'm worried that could be where this is headed. Shutter Island. Great movie, by the way. All right, where were we? So he himself differentiated between bounded and centered, bounded and centered in the way that he approached this.
Yeah.
And if you remember, bounded groups are defined by a boundary. And boundaries aren't necessarily bad things. Sometimes they're really good and healthy things. But if they're used to describe insiders from outsiders or to shame or to whatever, they can become very negative things, which Jesus opposes. Centered sets are focused on everyone's relationship to the center instead of everyone's relationship to the boundary line.
Yeah.
And so we spent a lot of time on this. I'm not going to spend a lot of time reviewing it, but centered relationships do have rules, wisdom, guidelines for sure. But they're not bounded. Rather, they're presented in an invitational way along the lines of wisdom, and which is how we've talked to our kids about these sorts of things. The goal isn't the real tragedy of purity culture was, hey, the only thing that matters is getting to your honeymoon as a technical virgin. And that was kind of the big point. It wasn't whether or not you had a healthy relationship with your body or you had a healthy relationship with the opposite sex or whether you had a healthy relationship with sexuality itself. It was, here's the line and please don't cross it, which then raised the classic questions of every junior high boy and girl in the history of the world, which is, well, how far can we go before that line? These days, I'm not even sure people are asking the line question anymore. Right. So I have no comment on the student leader's approach to this or their heart or whatever. I mean, this was the same wisdom and guidance, of course, I got and have given. So no harm, no foul towards whoever this, you know, person is. I do think it is interesting that and the reason I wanted to engage the question is because you can approach these topics in a very different way from how they're normally approached. And obviously bounded and centered, that's a central facet of how differently you can express opinions and beliefs about this stuff. But I also wanted to approach it from more of a kind of a broader picture about what it is to discern right doing in the world. If you're going to play the Romans 13, obey the governing authorities, I'm all for that as long as you don't speed. There are no other shortcuts around that. If that's an absolute for you, then great. If your non-favorite candidate wins the election and you're not marching around saying, well, this was rigged and stolen because you actually believe that God installs the governing authority. So God installed Biden as he installed the previous president. Great. As long as you're consistent with that, I love it. My experience is that a lot of people just are not at all consistent with that. And even my experience as a chaplain for police departments, there are greater and lesser matters of the law that certain departments will emphasize over other issues. So I don't know that that just settles everything, like being at an apartment where there's alcohol and you not even participating in it is somehow a compromise of your witness. Not sure I buy that. Jesus, again, following the model of Jesus, Jesus hung out with people so scandalously that he was accused of condoning their sin. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that we get the option of just saying, hey, there's sin happening here, so we can't be here or else we're in danger of affirming it. I think that is a very wrongheaded approach to what it is to bearing witness to the gospel. But I also think, hey, I love partying, and I love Jesus, and I'm suspicious of the guy that tells me to stop partying isn't a great example of how to be faithful either. So only because I don't know what I love partying means to you. And, you know, I happen to be the kind of person who is wonderfully deluded about my biases. And I often find that I find loopholes for the things that I really enjoy. I don't talk a lot about greed. Even though I am a very middle-class, comfortable person. You know what I mean? Like, we have these sort of blind spots. And so when you said, like, yeah, I love partying, but this guy's saying we can't do it, but I love Jesus. And it's like, okay. I mean, maybe there's a better way to approach the whole topic than either his way or, hey, I really like this, whatever. And I'm not saying that's what you're saying, but I'm saying that's how you could hear what you were saying. Tim, do you have thoughts on this so far?
I always just feel like it's a posture thing. So
say more about that.
In the experiences of purity culture as the example, lines were drawn without specific reasoning. And then they were set up for like exactly what you said. And we've talked about it to the nth degree on here already about being set up for failure in marriage because of these rules that weren't whatever. And I feel the same thing. Like, one, you know, what's self-control is a really important fruit, but it invites you, like, it gives you a lot of agency in the situation. I hate rules and weird things that people make up for no reason, just to kind of adhere to some track. Mm-hmm. When it's like, when I think about this, like while you were just talking, I was thinking about the Sermon on the Mount and how every one of those was like, you know, you heard this, but let's kind of like, it's more about, and that's, I feel like he's inviting everybody into, this is what it looks like to live in community with people. And you have a lot of agency within that. It's not just like black, white, right, wrong. There's like, there's different situations which you have to have discernment and self-control within. And that's, I think that's what we should be teaching people, is again, to harp on it, critical thinking, and that allows you to
take in
information, process it, and make the best decision you can. Rather than just being like, because I, you know, the purity culture thing was like, don't do this. And then what do? We push those lines and limits as much as we can. And then when we enter marriage, the danger's out. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like the danger, I think the drinking and that kind of stuff has the same thing where it's like, I don't think drinking is bad. But when you're told that doing these things is just like completely black and white wrong, then we push the limits on it. And then the danger of it is as addicting as the substances. And there was the same thing with sex where it's like, don't do these things. And you get in a marriage and all of a sudden the danger's gone. And that can kind of mess up your intimacy.
Yeah.
And you're like, why isn't this risky anymore? Why isn't this like exciting in that way?
Right. Right.
And then you're just set up for disaster. So but what did you do? You followed the rules that the youth pastor gave you.
Yeah. So what Tim and I are saying, him better than I, is that if Christianity is presented as a sin form of sin management, where the goal is for you to stop sinning,
good luck.
Then he and I, and often that's presented in a very bounded way, like here are the rules, and often they're rules that don't have biblical backing. There's no biblical backing that says don't go to a party with alcohol. Jesus did. Right,
he brought it,
and he turned it.
He did the beer
into the good stuff, and so I'm always hesitant when people make hard and fast rules into areas where either Jesus contradicts them by his own example, or you don't have a biblical. You could simply say a centered approach to say, hey, listen, for me, I try to avoid situations where X, Y, and Z, and I would invite you to consider that posture as well. That's a centered approach to this. So I have two big thoughts. One thought is if Christianity isn't sin management, I think this is what you're talking about when you talk to your Catholic friend. Well, if it's just, hey, avoid these things and do these things, yeah, we've totally missed it. The goal of Christ following is to become like Jesus. Like if you believe that he's the best way to be human, then all of those things that get in the way of being like Jesus, like my anger, my rage, drunkenness, lust, pride, greed, those aren't things that disqualify me from the kingdom of God, but those are things that have to be overcome in my pursuit of Jesus likeness. And I'm not doing them in order to be approved of by God or win his, you know, seal of belonging. I've already got that, but I'm doing them because I actually find the person of Jesus super compelling. And so the reason when I get really angry that I have to try to forgive is because I've lived in a world where bitterness was a dominant flavor of life. And that's just a horrible world to live in. I've lived where greed was running my life or lust was running my life. I've never had a huge issue with alcohol. I've always had a fun enough personality that I never needed it to have fun or be social or whatever. But I could see scenarios where I would have to be super careful. So the issue for you isn't, hey, should I have a drink here or not? The issue for you is, what is a healthy and Jesus-centered relationship with alcohol look like? It may look like obeying the governing authorities. It may look like, hey, I'm in a situation where I'm wanting to maintain relationships with these people, and I'm just going to sip on a beer in order to maintain relationships with these people. I don't know. But this is where the self-deluding part comes in, because I can say I've got a really healthy relationship with food, and then I look at the scale and go, evidently not. So what a healthy relationship is with regarding alcohol or sexuality or whatever is going to vary a bit from person to person, depending on their background and their proclivities and their personality. Absolutely.
It's hard to give hard and fast rules when we're all such different human beings.
Yeah. Yeah. I can have two Coors Lights and not, I mean, that's the equivalent of Pepsi. I mean, it's just, there's nothing to it. I just like the taste of it. Other people could have one Coors Light, and because of their background and genetic disposition, man, they go on a bender that's days long.
That's very different.
And so it is different, absolutely. But the college leader does have a point in saying that your choice about how to engage in alcohol does affect more than you. Because we're communal people, like Paul will say to the church in Ephesians, hey, don't get drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. And the difference there is something Tim was hinting at, that drunk with wine is not the best place to reflect Jesus. And so it's held in opposition to the idea that I can in my community be sober according to wine, but filled and, quote, drunk, not in the Pentecostal way necessarily, right. But with the Spirit. And so is this, Tim, is this making sense, first of all?
Yeah, there was a pastor at Rock Harbor Church years ago named Mike Erie, who gave a sermon on, it was all the thou shalt nots, but that for every thou shalt not, there's a thou shalt. And it,
it
stuck with me because it's one of those things where there is a balance that it's not just shutting something down. There's always something else that's coming in tandem with it. And
yes,
because we like to live yelling no instead of engaging in what the larger conversation is the situation.
Yes. Yes. So exactly. And that's the sin management thing. I don't know. That guy's fallen on hard times is what I hear. He can't show his face on the internet. He just has his voice. But to the question asker, I'm so proud of you for being a sophomore in college and wrestling with these issues and having the spidey sense that's like, I'm not sure that's the right way to frame this. Yeah. I just want us to be cautious about the way that we lie to ourselves. That's nothing about you. That's on me. That's what I do. But I also want to say, listen, if the following Jesus is presented as managing sin and saying no, then we've really missed something. Jesus himself talks about the kingdom as a treasure that you find. And if it's not being presented like that, then we've got issues. The last thing I want to say is I want to talk about discernment because this is Tim's gig right here. This is Tim's like meal ticket. When he talks about critical thinking, here's what he's talking about. When in the Bible it says, when Jesus says to his followers, hey, he doesn't say it this way, but be in the world, but not of the world. Mm-hmm. I leave you in the world. I do not take you out of the world, he says. The word world, and we've covered this ad nauseum over the 9 years of the podcast, it can mean three different things. So world can mean like in the world, not of the world. World can mean the created, like earth, land, globey thing. The world can mean the inhabited people of the globey thing, right? So God so loved the world, he gave his one and only son. It doesn't mean he loved the plants. It means he loved the people of the world. Or it can mean the organized system of hostile spiritual and human rebellion that wars against the purposes of God in the world, sometimes in a very organized manner and sometimes in a very disorganized manner. So when James will say, you know, do not love the world or anything in the world, or you must hate the world, like that's the third sense of it being used. Now, the tricky part is this. People will try to tell you that anything that's explicitly not Christian belongs to the world in that third sense. But that's not true. So some people will equate the organized and hostile system of human and spiritual being rebellion. They'll say anything that's secular is a part of that. But that's not the biblical testimony. The biblical testimony is that Paul will come across poets and prophets who are speaking in praise of Zeus, and he will take some of their lines and use them in preaching, which means he found something that's true and he reuses it, repurposes it for the image of Jesus. You know, Proverbs will say, look, just observe the natural world. You can learn things from ants. Mm-hmm. You can learn things from the consequences of other people's sin, right? I mean, there's a creation itself is said to declare truth about God's character. So part of the world in the third sense is, all right, we have to discern. We can't just sit and label everything not Christian. And the real tricky part is there are some things that are labeled Christian that aren't.
Yeah, I was going to say,
who defines that? There are some things that are labeled non-Christian that are, which is super hard to discern. And so what we're called to do is there are parts of non-Christian culture that we can receive and repurpose. Hallelujah. Baskin-Robbins ice cream, medical care, You know, there was an electrician over today at my house. Hallelujah for that person. There are parts of non-Christian culture that need to be rejected, right? I'm not going to start a meth addicts for Christ ministry. You know, that wouldn't probably be a good thing for my personality type. There are parts of non-Christian culture that we stand in opposition to. And then there are other parts of non-Christian culture that can be redeemed, where we, and redeem here means we tell a better story with it. And that's the goal of sexuality. That's the goal of alcohol, is that these are things that are in our world that can be used for good or bad. And the Christian is to tell a better story with those things. So if our engagement with alcohol looks like me blacking out, or me pushing boundaries, or, you know, me doing things that do not reflect well on the name of Jesus, then at that point I'd say, hey, let's pull back on that. If my engagement with alcohol can be done in a way that allows for relationship and self-control, kindness, patience, gentleness, all the things, then hallelujah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. But the problem is the discernment often happens individually or in smaller groups. It can't happen for the entire, you know, culture at large. You know what I mean? So yeah. Just saying, listen, never go into a party where you have alcohol. I don't know. I don't know that would be the New Testament teaching. Anyway, thoughts. and just so you know, this is how I've parented my kids.
Yeah.
This is exactly how I've parented my kids.
This is what I tell my students too, is like, you guys are at the age right now in college, so same age as this emailer, where a lot of the decisions and opinions that you form start to become the foundation of who you're going to be as an adult. So ask these questions. Ask a lot of questions. Ask every hard question that pops in your head and, you know, test those answers and see where they land and where they're rooted in and why and how. I think asking questions can be you always say this too, when people are like, how should I read the Bible? And you're like, start in Matthew and write down every single question you have in the margins. Anything that you don't understand or whatever, write that question down. And then, and when you finish it, start again. And I think that's a really wise way to do that, of like asking hard questions over and over again to figure out, don't just take everything that's handed to you, ask some questions.
Yeah. Well, and think about the kind of questions you would ask, like for you and your friend, to ask, sit down as a 19, 20 year old and say, what's a healthy relationship with alcohol look like? You've already differentiated yourself from the vast majority of your peers by simply asking the question and taking it seriously. I think that's what Jesus is after, that we're not just thoughtlessly doing what's normal, because normal isn't always good. Right. Normal has to be discerned. It's normal to seek revenge. It's normal to try to cultivate an image on social media that isn't true to you, you know, whatever. It's normal to want to be rich. I think the gospel calls normal into question all over the place.
Right.
And so for you to sit there and say, hey, what is a different kind of normal look like for us? I think that's a great question. And just being told a rule will often not allow those kinds of discussions to take place.
Yeah. I've been trying really, really hard lately to lean as hard as I can into this, like, dignifying the humanity and other people, like the love your enemy and why, and kind of, I'm trying to develop those muscles right now as much as I can.
Yeah.
Because I think it's really core in what I'm learning. It's so core and central to gospel is this restoration of humanity. And when I look at things like sex and alcohol, they can be really wonderful things. They can also be dehumanizing things. So it's like learning how That's to right. use these things in a healthy way is a wonderful gift. Like sex can be a wonderful gift. Alcohol can also be kind of a wonderful gift, but it can also kill you. it's like it can be really dangerous if it's not used in a way that dignifies humanity.
That's right.
And so I've been looking at everything.
Your humanity
and
the humanity
exactly.
of others.
So who I am is leaning into me being the most human I can be and also dignifying the humanity in other people to the highest extent that I possibly can and seeking that.
Yep.
I think that's for me, it's been a simple way of how I approach a lot of communal things and just like trying. And that also then pulls in anger and all those other things too, because I have to check those things as I'm trying to dignify someone's humanity or the way that the anger and stress harms me.
Right. So instead of, so if I were that campus leader, what I would have wanted to do is sit down and maybe they did and have just a really fun conversation about that.
Yeah.
And have that, have the invitation of being co-students together through text, because, you know, for me, I've seen enough harm done.
Yeah.
And I've heard enough stories of sexual assault, and that I have, you know, it would be my wish for my kids to just stay away from it altogether. I mean, if they just said, "Hey, Dad, what would you want us?" I'd say, "Learn to function without it." And then enjoy it down the road when you're in much safer environments.
Yeah.
But I also can't control what they do. And if I give a hard and fast rule that's in or out in terms of my approval, then they'll just hide if they are doing it.
Yeah.
And my greater value isn't their hiding. My greater value is our connection in the midst of whatever's really going on in their life. So anywho, it's a tough issue. And I have, I'm sympathetic to campus ministers who, you know, get asked these questions all the time and see the harm it does and the temptation to just, you know, draw a hard and fast line. I remember I spoke at a campus ministry, like really big conference, and we got a question about masturbation. And I said, it depends on whether or not it's always sinning. And you know, and I gave an answer that's similar to this. You know, I can imagine scenarios where it is sin, and I can imagine scenarios where maybe it's the lesser of evils or whatever. And good night. did I get in a little bit of trouble for that? And not, you know, because the rule's easier. Yes, it's always wrong.
Way easier.
Way easier.
Way easier from that person's seat.
Right. But to deal with the issues of why do I, mm-hmm. what sits behind that,
yep.
is what shame is sitting there. What messaging? Like, if you just react to the symptoms, you never get to the root. And that was what I was trying to say, is the issue isn't masturbation. That's not the issue, right? The issue is, how are we viewing sexuality in our relationship to God, mm-hmm. and whether or not it's a thou shalt not or a thou shalt, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly what this old preacher said back in the day. All right. Well, since Phil stole all of our thunder in Genesis 1, and Phil, you know what's great is Phil and Sky often listen to this and steal our stuff.
All the time.
And absolutely. No. They do not. But they like Phil texted me, I think today, he was like, "Okay, Seth's comment about Tim was hilarious." So we love those guys so much, and we're just busting chops. All right. Genesis 1, to be human.
I just shared their abortion video with one of my students, so we'll see how that goes over.
Right.
The writing papers. Yeah, they do. So like, there's more to this topic than you're wrestling with. Here's a video from a Christian talking a little bit more nuanced about the topic.
Yes.
So if I get fired, it's Phil's fault.
Bro, there it is. He owes you. He owes you work.
That's right.
All right. Genesis 1. What does it mean to be human? That's the question we're trying to answer. And this, you know, the question we were just wrestling with flows out of
Look at
this.
You go.
Boom. See, then God said, this is, so we go through a pattern of 6 days where on the first 3 days, God takes something that's empty or formless and he forms environments. And then he takes things that are void or empty, and then he fills the things that he formed. So day 1 and 3 go together. Day 2 and 4 go together. Day 5 and 6 go together. So God will form something in those first 3 days, and then he'll fill it in the second 3 days. So we meet the land. And by land, of course, we don't mean the globe. They wouldn't have had that conception. They just literally mean the stuff I'm standing on that's down here. And we meet human persons for the first time in this account. So verse 26, God said, and we're going to take our sweet time through this. There is so much in here. Good Lord. Then God said, "Let us make humanity." Now the us, who's the us? I'm pretty convinced the us is not the Trinity. That would not have been in the brains of those folks. I think the us is the divine council that we've talked about before, and we'll talk about again by the time we get to Genesis 6 and the Nephilim. Oh, yeah. Oh, we're going there, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, yes. So I think that's who the us is, but that's a discussion for another day. God said, let us make humanity in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish, the birds, the livestock, all the wild animals, and over the creatures that move along the ground. Now, the two key words, and we're going to spend loads of time on this, are image and likeness. And they're used here in parallel. Image is the word selim. Likeness is the word demut.
Demut.
And, yep. And their stock, selim in particular, their stock words for idols, for statues, for idol statues. when in the ancient world, and particularly the ancient Near East, to be made in the image of God meant one of two things. Either it was reserved for one of two things, either idols or kings. So idols were physical representations of the deity that would stand in temples, right? That would be a selim or an image, but it would literally just be a statue. Kings were thought also to be images of the gods. Mm-hmm. So you have, we'll look at some vocabulary in a little bit of all this image that, that this king was the image of so-and-so god, all right? So in the ancient Near East, these were common words used for statues and kings. And here, let us make humanity in our image and likeness, all right? That's a really big metaphysical theological statement that we're going to spend like loads of time unpacking. So point number one, big point number one, is that selim, image, is one of the standard biblical vocabulary terms for idol statue. So in Numbers chapter 5 or chapter 33, it says this, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all of their figured stones and destroy all of their molten images, selim, and demolish all their high places. So anything associated with idolatry, destroy it or else you'll be tempted by it. Hmm. And one of those options was molten images. I don't know what molten means in this regard. But the idea that maybe they were cast in through fire or something forged, yeah, I have no idea. But that's the word selim is used there. So an image of a false god is a selim. Second Kings uses it in the same way. All the people of the land went to the house of Baal, who is the Syrian storm god, and they tore it down. All of his altars and images, they broke in pieces thoroughly. An image is just a statue, all right? So that becomes really important for the following reason. When people talk about the image of God, very often, and we're going to look at this more next week, they often will talk about the image of God in terms of some sort of relational capacity that we have. So we have the ability to have rational thought or freedom of choice or make moral decisions or relate to God. And that's what it means to be in the image of God. But this is something far more concrete. This is saying the way that an idol statue functions in the ancient Near Eastern temple world is the way that human beings function in Yahweh's temple world. Hmm. And so one scholar says it this way, Genesis 1 can only be understood against the background of an ancient Yahweh statue. So it's interesting when you go later in the Old Testament and you go into the Holy of Holies and you're like, there's the Ark of the Covenant and then there are the cherubim that have wings folded in towards each other. And then on the mercy seat, the top of the ark, that's where God is, but there's no physical representation. And when people would invade the Jerusalem temple I don't know if it was the Babylonians or the Assyrians or the Romans or whatever, but they would mock the God of Israel because the God of Israel had no form. Mm. It was just an empty room. And so what this scholar is saying is that if you went into another ancient Near Eastern temple for Baal or whoever, you would see statues of the God. Whenever a human being went in to the Eden place or the temple or the tabernacle, the reason there weren't other statues there is because the human was the statue. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, so he goes on, he says, humanity is regarded as the statue of God. Hmm. Humans were thus created to be living statues of the deity. There was no need for a divine image because humans represented Yahweh as a statue would have done. And this further finds confirmation in the fact that when the biblical writers critique the idols, they don't critique idols like, hey, you guys are so dumb to have statues. They critique idols by saying your statues don't live and move and breathe right, like Yahweh statues do. Do you see the difference?
Totally.
Oh, it's brilliant. So yes, we're statues of Yahweh. So the critique wasn't, oh, you idiots having images of your God. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the point. The point was your images are dead and Yahweh's images are living, talking, breathing. Man. That's so beautiful. That's so much deeper than just how did those ancient idiots,
right,
you know, they worshiped fire and wood and metal and stone. No, they worshiped images of their gods. And the reason Yahweh said there is no image allowed of Yahweh is because, first of all, Yahweh can't be captured in any physical, he's separate from physical creation. Right. But secondly, because the humans were meant to be the image of Yahweh,
right,
in the world. Oh, man, that'll preach, right? So when the high priest would walk into the temple or the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle or temple once a year, the high priest was the statue. Mm. You know, the reason there wasn't any other statue is because the high priest is the statue. I mean, it's brilliant. Tim Mackey loves a scholar named Crispin Fletcher Lewis.
It's quite a name.
Which is a great name. And so Mackey, I didn't read this book, but Mackey quotes Crispin, and I'm quoting Mackey. So to appreciate the full force of this image of God in humanity theology, we must have in mind the role of idols in ancient Near Eastern religion, where an idol is set up to be the real presence of the God. Mm-hmm. So the statue represented the reality, right? If you'd place the statue in a place where that God supposedly ruled and reigned and had right, control. Because the God is really believed to inhabit the image is the God, and its proper care and veneration guarantees the God's benefits and protection for the worshiping community. With this understanding of divine images assumed, Genesis 1 has a sharply focused theological anthropology. Now, this is super important. Humanity is to be the eyes, ears, mouth, being, and action of the Creator within his creation. This point gives the biblical prohibition of idolatry its strongest possible rationale. For humans to make an idol is foolish because it fails to appreciate that according to the original order of creation, it is humanity that functions in relationship to God, as do the idols in relationship to their gods.
What did it say? So he says it's foolish. Is that what the word was?
Yes. It's foolish. For humans to make an idol is foolish because it fails to appreciate that according to the original order, it is humanity that functions in relation to Yahweh as the statues function to their gods. So a couple of things that are like, I can't stress how big these points are. The first one is this. It isn't, and man, are we going to unpack. It isn't some capacity in humanity that images God. It is the fullness of humans as humans.
That's a big
that
deal.
Images God.
Yeah.
That is a big deal, particularly when you look at Seth Erie, who has diminished capacities. If it is some capacity that causes us to be in the image of God, then what about people in a coma? Mm-hmm. You know, what about people who never can speak or relate or whatever? And no. It's being in the image of God isn't, we're not just made in the image. We are, as humans, in the image. It's our humanity that images God. That's why Jesus is the perfect image of God, not because he's God, but because he's fully human.
Man, that pulls so many things into it that we've
like, say
just,
more.
Well, just the way in which we've compartmentalized humanity throughout history with who has value and who does not, whether it's
totally
in those capacities or not, like whether it's race, gender, anything.
Yes.
It just gets God's fascinating.
Yes. God's image is not something we carry or not something we have or not something we do
or achieve.
It's all of those. Yeah. It's all of those because it's something we are. Mm-hmm. So, and notice we image God not just in religious matters. We haven't met any religious words yet.
Right.
There's no sacrifice. There's no worship. There's nothing. It's just
being
by simply being human.
Yeah.
You are a statue of Yahweh. Mm. And you are a visible representation of what Yahweh's like. You're a mediating representation of creation and Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And you find your full humanness in relationship to Yahweh and other image bearers. So this is so important to me because I remember, I would hear about my spiritual life all the time. I would have my devotional life, my inner life, my spiritual life.
A lot of lives.
And that seemed divorced the days of our lives. It just seemed divorced from like what it meant to be human, like all the things. So I would read about Bible study and prayer and fasting and solitude and silence and hallelujah. Those things are so important. But I never read anything about driving or being angry or dating except kissing it goodbye.
Or those things were... And they were antithetical to your humanness. They were things
yes.
you did to be oh, outside yes. of your humanness.
Yes, yes.
To abstain
yes. sexuality.
From humanness.
Yeah, sexuality, your humanness and sexuality gets in the way of your spiritual.
Exactly.
Yep. Like it was almost like your humanness gets in the way. And it does, yes. But that's not where the story starts. The story starts simply saying what it is to be human, to have to sleep and eat and drink, to reproduce, to work, to think. That whole thing is image of God, mm-hmm. all of that. So it's not something you do, and it's not something you carry, and it's not something you act on. It's just you.
Well, imagine if Jesus modeled humanity that way, the old way of thinking that we had. He would just have locked himself in a room until death.
Totally.
Like,
because he had to stay pure.
Exactly. Instead, like I asked yeah. you this question a long time ago, and we were talking about temptations and what... like whether or not Jesus experienced a temptation of lust, but did not act upon it. Things like that, where it's like...
And the answer is yes, of course.
But
he
we
did.
Don't talk about that because that feels... Even saying it right. out loud kind of makes me feel weird because right. of these old ways of thinking or whatever. But it's like, that's not... Being human is not being like...
Come on.
Secluding yourself from these that's things. Right. It's learning how to that's navigate right. through them in a way that
exactly
dignifies
right.
your humanity and other people.
Part of being human is being embodied.
Yeah.
Part of being human is having desire.
Love it.
I mean, it's like, yeah. And so all of a sudden, salvation can't just be limited to this little piece of me called a soul.
No.
Because that's not what the problem is. The problem isn't that we have bent souls. The problem is that the statues of Yahweh are imaging something else.
Yeah.
into the world.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And so to be redeemed means their image of Yahweh now in the person of Jesus is restored.
Yeah.
So that's good. Their full humanity. So I mean, the big point number one is image of God is something we are. We're going to spend time on this next week, a lot of time on this, because that's a big deal. The other thing, and we're going to spend time on this next week too, is that the fact that this exalted status is given to all humanity. So remember, Selim can refer to one of two things, either idol statues of gods, or what was the other one? Do you remember?
Kings.
So
kings.
In the ancient Near Eastern world, we have loads of examples of image statements, but particularly around kings. So I'm just going to read you a few, even though I'm going to butcher the names of the gods. All right. To Adad, who was a Syrian deity. The likeness of Hadsili, the king, which he placed before Hadad, controller of water in heaven and earth. The image, the king's image, is for establishing his throne so that his utterance may please the gods. In other words, the image of the king was established because the king is the image of the god. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
In Egyptian royal ideology, Pharaoh was called the image of Ra. Mm-hmm. And we have like inscription after inscription. The prince of Ra, the child, his heir, the image of Ra, whom he created. Queen Hatshepsut is described as the superb image of Amon, the image of Amon on earth, the image of Amon Ra to eternity, his living monument on earth. Like, this was just the language of the ancient Near East. So when you saw an idol statue, you would think to yourself, okay, this means I'm under that God's authority.
Yeah, I'm talking about power over too. Like,
totally. And how you treat the idol is how you treat the God.
Yeah.
Bro, come on. Now, one last little thing here that is so freaking ridiculous. this is from Mackey, who I think got it from Walton. I don't know. But there was a process where you would take these idol statues and then you would bless them. And you would undergo a ceremony or ritual to kind of turn them into the images of God. Hmm. All right. And so this is described like it was called a mouth washing and mouth opening ceremony, accompanied by incantations and blessings, in which the deity's presence kind of became one with the statue. So there were these purification, charging, activating rituals, which then you would be like, okay, now this is the God right here. And there's some scholarship that says this is what God was doing when he said, let us make humanity in our image and our likeness. And then he blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Like, that ritual blessing was a part of that, as well as the part in Genesis 2 when God forms a human from the dust and breathes into his nostrils the breath of life. Breathing into the idol statue was one of the ways that you would transform the deaf and dumb statue into the image of the God. So I've only read that a couple of places, but I mean, it would fit in the genius of the Genesis accounts,
right?
What was a pile of dust now gets infused as an image of God.
Would
in a
they
very
say,
similar.
They were saying that their gods would breathe into the statue and that would make it.
Yeah.
That's
but
who's
you
doing
would,
the
but
breathing.
Priests would enact that.
Gotcha.
So priests would symbolically say these things knowing that the God would do it.
That would make a lot of sense then.
Totally. Now, one other big point to make, and so the other beings in Genesis 1 of being fruitful and increasing in number and filling the earth, like the animals are given that charge too. The unique thing that was given to the humans is the invitation to rule. And the Hebrew grammar here says that ruling is the purpose for the image. So you are an image. Why? Was Yahweh lonely? Was he narcissistic and just needed people telling him he was great? No. The reason he made images is so that they would rule. So another scholar, just as powerful earthly kings, to indicate their claim to dominion, erect an image of themselves in the provinces of their empire where they do not personally appear, so humans are placed on the earth in God's image as God's sovereign emblem. Right. So summarize. And again, I mean, I don't want to push too far into this because we have loads of episodes that are going to explore this more, but a couple of big points. Image and likeness were standard statue words that were used all over the ancient Near East. And you would know what those were. Those were physical representations of an invisible deity that were either images of kings or images of the deity themselves. And there was a ceremony that accompanied that where the image would be blessed and some sort of breathing thing would happen. And, you know, so there's some thought that maybe that's what Yahweh is doing in 1 and 2 with the humans. But the big point is that the statues were statues in their totality. It wasn't a part of what they did or a capacity they had. It was they were the statue. And so we are, like Crispin said, the eyes, the ears, the voice. That's why so much of the New Testament is us being together, mm-hmm. the image of God, right? Bot, because yeah. we are eyes and ears and voices. Yes. And there are times when I need eyes and ears and voices mm-hmm. To reflect back God's truth to me, right? When I confess sin to God, it's like, okay, well, I'm hoping this is okay. But when it says confess your sins to one another, pray mm-hmm. for each other that you might be healed, there's something there about another image bearer seeing and hearing and speaking words of forgiveness that carries extra weight.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So to be an image is to be a visible representation of Yahweh, not in some particular thing that you do or some religious aspect of your life, but in the totality of your humanity. And what we're going to see is what the fall turns out to be is that the humans now begin to image something else.
Yeah.
And in imaging something else, they dehumanize themselves and others.
That's what I was gonna say, yeah.
And sin gains momentum over human history so that Jesus has to come as a full human to properly image God. He doesn't image God in his godness.
What a congruent story. He images God in his humanness.
Right?
I love it.
I love it. So we thought,
well, the thing that you said, so we just said it again, but when you like, and you use Seth as the example, like not in our capacities, not in our this, that, X, Y, and Z, not in our color of our skin, abilities, anything, in our full humanness, which is different for most every human. If that's different for you than it is to me. And we're
totally
middle-class white dudes. So it's going to, those ripples of what that means are going to be profound. And then when you see exactly what you just said, like as soon as we start emulating or imaging something else, we compartmentalize, we try to rule over, and you can just see how that, you can see how that happens in the world, but you can also see that how that happens in the church and just the ramifications of that over absolutely. And over and over after thousands of years, wars, everything. It's just all of it, all of it's tied in there.
Yep.
So it's fascinating to think about it from that vantage point, though. Like the full humanness of everybody is
right.
That's just
is the image.
Wonderful spot to start.
Yeah. 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 I just wanted to make that point. And if that point got through.
Great point.
Now, one of the things we'll see in the future is that not everybody images God. But not everyone bears the name of Christ, right? So we've talked about carrying the name of Christ before, like, and so there is a redemptive community within humanity that has their humanity being slowly restored, you know, and so they carry the name of Jesus in ways that are different. But what the rest of the Bible is going to do with and talk about with. And it's even as interesting as when you read the Torah and the commands of the Torah, and they're so odd and so weird, and they deal with, you know, interest, and they deal with clothing and haircuts and how you decorate your house and sickness and mold.
Mold's terrible.
And you're like, they're like, what is that saying? Well, what it's saying is that there isn't one aspect of humanness that Yahweh is not interested in restoring. So every part of human life. So yes, you have cultic ritual in the Torah, right? This is how you offer this sacrifice. And this is, you wash your hands this many times and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But then you have about all the common parts of life, right? How to clean, how to disinfect, how to manage, you know, different diseases. I mean, it's just like every segment of human life is in view here. Hmm. It's not just, hey, let's teach these people to be religious so we can save their souls. It's no. As soul embodied creatures, how do they then, you know, image Yahweh well into the world?
Yeah.
And in so doing, humanize not only themselves, but others.
Yeah.
So that's the story, at least as I understand it. And again, the really big point, the really big reason you start in Genesis is because how you start determines the problem Jesus comes to solve.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If you start in 3, which is where I always started, mm-hmm. right? The gospel is you're a sinner. God is holy. There is distance between you and God because of your sin, and Jesus has come to bridge that distance. So if you accept his sacrifice and believe in him, you move over and can be close to God now and go to heaven when you die, right?
You cross that cross-shaped bridge that's over the canyon in between.
That's right. Exactly right. Exactly right.
Which every time I saw that youth group, I was like, how do they get over the wall in the middle of the, you know, where the top of the cross sticks up?
You know what? That's why,
that's why I got kicked out.
Exactly. So anyway, so brothers and sisters, this is a great place to start. And so Rob Bell, way back in the day, I think his first book, or he did a tour? I don't remember. But he had a thing, he had a riff that was like, everything is spiritual. And I remember I heard him say once, you know, there's no Hebrew word for spiritual. And in that form, that's true. Obviously, there's word for spirit all over the place. But I think this is what he was getting at, kind of ahead of the curve,
yeah.
You know, is that the whole thing, all of human life is what's being redeemed, not just the religious part.
Right.
So that when you go to a party, and you're considering alcohol or whatever, imaging, what does it look like to image God into that? And for some, it's funny because their image of God is a very boundaried, uptight, very angry deity. So their imaging will look like that.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe the imaging there is less focused on the specific behavior rules and more focused on, as you were saying, the posture with which those from which those rules sort of flow.
Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, I think there are loads of implications, and we'll get to them all. So speaking of God's image, Seth Erie, get over here. This young man images God well. Because, I mean, could you imagine? Like, one of my buddies has a he's very creative.
Dead.
And he wanted to – oh, yeah. He wanted to – one of his ideas for like a book or a movie was if – imagine someone with Down syndrome were rich and powerful and their desires were carried out. How good would the world be? When they, you know, because when they come across suffering or when they come across, right, they're just in. And I just thought, oh my goodness, I wonder who images God better.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's not even the right way to say that.
But you know, in the course, framework of all course, of this, but, like.
Right. But if you think that image bearing is like full efficiency and capacity, okay, then I image bearer better. Mm-hmm. But if image bearing is purity of heart, and, you know, living full humanness without any apology whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of think he wins. So, anywho, what's up, heavy breather?
Hey, Seb.
You win, bro.
Thanks.
Thanks. What do you want to do? How do you want to close it?
I can't do Shema. Muslim, I can do Professor KBU.
Okay. We're doing Shema?
No.
No? Okay. Yeah, let's do Bless You and Keep You Together, right?
No, not me.
What?
It's you.
What?
It's you.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I'm all alone. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord shine his face upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance to you. And today and in these days, may he give us peace.
Amen.
Amen.
Make it so. Thank you, thank you, thank you for listening to this conversation. The Voxology Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that is made possible by listeners just like you. If you'd like to partner with us, you can do so at patreon.com/voxologypodcast or on Tithe.ly, tithe.ly, search Voxology Podcast. You can interact with the hosts on Facebook/Voxology Podcast or on Instagram @Voxology Podcast and on Twitter or X, whatever it is, @MikeErie. Thank you, thank you, thank you for walking this long road with us.